Thank you very much, Kelly. Great job. I learned a new word, snow persons. Huh? It's ironic. Annual meeting of the Philadelphia Society in Dallas, Texas, just like the Dallas Cowboys recently stole, of all things, the son of the hated Buddy Ryan to be our defensive coordinator and somehow make the Dallas Cowboys a little better. But it's great to be with you today. I'm going to give a little bit of a different twist on the subject that's before us today and address the issue of ideologies that threaten our roots of family, church, and school. I think many of us of our generation, the 60s generation, or those who got involved in the conservative movement in the 1950s, we dealt, if you will, with an ideology which was dominant at the time and really antagonistic in a long-term basis to the roots of family, church, and school. And that, of course, was big government liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt through John F. Kennedy, through LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and the Great Society. And the centralizing impulse and the idea somehow you can grow the power of the federal government, it ultimately was a form of utopianism. And particularly the executive branch of government, you may remember back then a prominent book by James McGregor Burns called The Deadlock of Democracy, how Congress was thwarting the will of the executive and how we needed a more powerful executive. And so it was a combination on the part of the big government liberals. If they couldn't get their way through the executive branch, then they, beginning with the Warren Court in particularly, and extending thereafter, they would use the federal courts. When they couldn't get Congress, state legislatures, or local municipalities, elected bodies of local municipalities to put their policies in place, then essentially they would use the federal courts as part of the centralizing impulse. And, of course, a classic example of that many years later was the Roe v. Wade decision, which essentially threw out all 50 states' laws limiting or prohibiting abortion in our society. Ironically, there's a real opportunity. In fact, when I was in the Reagan administration, there was a huge debate as to what approach we should take to undo what the court had done, and the choice was the Hatch Amendment, which was a constitutional amendment, or the East approach, which was a legislative approach, which essentially, pursuant to Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, would limit jurisdiction of the federal courts to what essentially are political questions, and particularly questions such as abortion. Unfortunately, we went in a different direction, and I think that was a strategic mistake in terms of bringing the federal court's power, much of what was addressed by Kelly a little earlier, under greater control. But interesting enough, most of us back then who got involved, I was part of the Goldwater movement as a young student at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I read books that really attacked that centralizing process, up from liberalism by Bill Buckley, The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek, Conscience of a Conservative by Barry Goldwater and Brent Bozell Jr. And in all of those cases, it was really an argument for the first time in modern times of the dangers of this centralizing influence. And a real, I think people tend to talk about the 60s in terms of the new left, the student left, the radical movement. But in the early part of the 60s, there was a very forceful movement to begin to undo the centralizing power of the federal government. And I have a quote in my book, Bringing America Home, from the Conscience of a Conservative, which really reflects, I think, our attitude then and what I think is our attitude coming back. The time will come, this is from the Conscience of a Conservative, when we entrust the conduct of our affairs to the men who understand that their first duty as public officials is to divest themselves of the power that they've been given. It will come when Americans in hundreds of communities throughout the nation decide to put the man in office who is pledged to enforce the Constitution and restore the Republic. That was one of the rallying cries for so many of us that became involved in the conservative movement or the intellectual aspect of the conservative force at the time. Unfortunately, with the assassination of Kennedy, the rise of the new left in the 60s, we had a changing dynamic. And then let me go to that next phase, if you will. The radical left really led by people like Tom Hayden and the Students for a Democratic Society. I remember being in D.C. at the time. It was before I enlisted in the Army and went to Vietnam, but literally at demonstrations in Washington, D.C., you had signs referring to our soldiers in Vietnam as baby killers, the demonization of the American soldiers, and literally supporting the other side, the communist North Vietnamese and their Viet Cong allies in that war. You had, with the new left, not the subtle assault on our traditional values, but a frontal assault to undermine those traditional values. And unfortunately, I think it, in spite of the fact that ultimately the student left, the radical movement, as it moved into excesses and Weatherman, as Vietnam was over, it began to lose influence. Nonetheless, it had enormous influence over the culture, that frontal assault on the culture, and really the understanding of Gramsci, the communist, changed the country, changed the culture, and you can change the society. It was enormously effective, so that today, in effect, the counterculture of the 60s has become the dominant culture of our times. And even in a state like Texas, which votes overwhelmingly conservative, is strong, is still in its values in terms of the average people in our state, the typical Texan, nonetheless, you could have at one of our most prestigious universities here in the state, the University of Texas, when a fine professor by the name of Rob Kuhn sets up a course dedicated to Western civilization, one course dedicated to Western civilization, written up favorably in the New York Times. The radicals who, unfortunately, we tenured the 60s radicals as professors and who really appoint their own, and particularly in the arts and arts side of things, rose up and did what they could very quickly to make sure that that course was gone. And again, and although this statement was made decades later from the 60s, but Jesse Jackson's comment at Stanford when he was fighting a course in Western civilization, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western civ has to go, is in a way reflective of what has happened as we've tenured the radicals. And in a way, the culture has been captured by the left, and it's enormously confusing to the American people and has done enormous damage to the family, the church, and our schools. The other thing about Barry Goldwater, which was fascinating and tends to be forgotten even in so-called Republican administrations that claim to be conservative in the post-Reagan period of American politics, was his great emphasis on local control of education, the dangers of federal power over education. With federal money will come federal control, and the danger of the centralizing influence, if you will, on education, which ought to be local, controlled locally, and reflect the diversity of a state and our various states around the nation. But with the decline of the so-called new left or radical left, nonetheless, quietly, there was a new force at work. It was called the Alinsky Movement, and the founder was the late Saul Alinsky, who wrote a book, Rules for Radicals, dedicated to the first radical, Lucifer. And they had a very clever twist, if you will, because claiming to be, if you will, concerned about communities, churches, the local sense of things, they did what they could to infiltrate, if you will, churches. The Catholic Church in particular, which was once known as a bastion of anti-communism, was their first target. Alinsky set up his base of operations in Chicago, and within a reasonably short period of time began to have enormous influence in moving the Catholic Church in this country in a direction to the hard left. Ostensibly, they were building base communities and working with local community organizers, but the reality is you had to salute, you had to stay with the party line, you had to, if you will, you were trained to be a community organizer and to believe in the tenets you were taught, which again were reflective of this break with the American political tradition that came in the 60s. Very much the end justifies the means, the idea whatever works, it's about power. And the sad thing is that we didn't pay much attention to it in the 70s. I remember when President Reagan appointed me to be director of action. My predecessor was Sam Brown, who literally had supported the other side during the Vietnam War. But Sam also was funding the Alinsky groups to the tune of about $20 million. Various ACORN groups, Alinsky groups, all over the country. We defunded that within a reasonably short period of time. I think it took us about a year. But at the same time, just like termites eating away at the foundations, here they were very effectively using our own tax dollars to undermine our values and also beginning to divide people within the churches. Literally, when we defunded them at Action, they went over immediately and got funding for the Campaign for Human Development in the Catholic Church, which I happen to be a member of. Now, my good friend, the leader in the Philadelphia Society, Bill Campbell, his own Episcopalian community is wrestling with this. And there was a tremendous movement, and it continues even today, to infiltrate, influence, and move people in the mainstream Protestant churches and the Catholic churches around the country in the direction of this kind of utopianism, which ultimately is an attack on family, church, and schools, local our local sense of education. So this is an issue that we have to address. And unfortunately, the post-Reagan period of American politics, even when Republicans were in, they didn't pay attention to it until all of a sudden, thanks to some young kids out there who brought to the public's attention what was actually going on with taxpayer dollars to begin to undo part of that process. And what they're doing is simply changing names and going back to it again. But again, that's one of the ideologies that, in my judgment, constitute a major threat to these platoons of family, school, and church in American society. But unfortunately, I think we've got a couple of elements even within our own institutions, those of us who happen as Bill said a little earlier, yes, I have been involved in the political realm with state party chairman for a while, worked in the Reagan administration, and have been very frustrated by what's happened in the post-Reagan period of American politics. But just like there was enormous confusion sown when the Alinsky faction became so influential within the Catholic Church in our own ranks, I saw it when I was representing the White House in the Rio Grande Valley, and literally the Catholic bishop down there turned over his churches to this bunch. We were successful in working with a lot of community leaders. President Reagan did very well down there, but nonetheless, it shows the confusion that's sown in the ranks when people who are essentially utopians or non-conservatives gain influence with what was traditionally a conservative institution, in that case, the Catholic Church. I think what has happened in the post-Reagan period of American politics, I've got a chapter in my book called Big Government Conservatism is an Oxymoron. We fell in love with the idea, or at least some Republicans did, and even some people calling themselves conservatives. A term was used, national greatness conservative, that somehow if our folks got in power, everything would be all right and we would tinker or we would change things or we would do it the right way. And that centralizing impulse, which those of us who were in the early conservative movement objected to, suddenly became in fashion. Now, to me, big government conservatism is nothing more than a watered-down version of big government liberalism. But nonetheless, you see in the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, for example, the Department of Education with the No Child Left Behind legislation passed in conjunction with Teddy Kennedy, literally we doubled spending at the federal level, increased the mandates in a so-called conservative Republican administration. The little agency I headed called Action back in 1985 when I had left, and our motto was doing more with less. We literally had cut the budget by 25%. We'd cut the bureaucracy in half. And yet when I left in 1985, at the end of the George W. Bush administration, the budget for that agency was eight times what it was back in 1985. Now under Obama, it's 10 times. So what we have done in a way by returning to what I would call, what we used to call Rockefeller Republicanism, is grow that centralizing impulse and then turn it over to the most liberal or radical regime in American history. And they simply have increased it as they have at Action. I think the budget now is 10 times what it was back when we left. So that's issue number one that I think we as conservatives have got to address and have got to be willing to say that some major mistakes were made and some people who claim to be conservatives are not and really are not going to be part of the solution, particularly when they do not acknowledge the faults they have for getting us into the mess in the first place. You take the Medicare entitlement. I don't know if my friend Don Devine is here or not. I saw Don last night. Don led the effort in a Republican administration to stop or block the first new entitlement since the LBJ days, an entitlement which is costing us unfunded in excess of $50 billion a year, or $7.2 trillion, I understand, over the life of the program. About all it's going to do is speed up the period of time in which Medicare goes bankrupt. But this was pushed through by ostensibly a conservative or a Republican administration in 2003 in order to help reelect the president in 2004. And again, it's that centralizing impulse, if you will, more and more power to the government in a healthcare system where literally we pay twice as much as Swedes pay and don't live as long for a healthcare system. But John Goodman, I'm sure, is going to address that issue. So I think we have to make a fundamental break, if you will, with the folks that hijacked the conservative movement and moved us in the wrong direction. And secondly, I would add that it is not conservatism to have a foreign policy which is Wilsonian in trying to make the world safe for a democracy and somehow believes you can use U.S. military force in order to impose democracy in the Middle East. We had the Bosnian War in the Clinton administration in which during that time the neoliberals pushed for military action in the U.S. on behalf of the radical Islamic KLA. We had the preemptive war in Iraq, the architect of whom was Paul Wolfowitz, who was also supportive, by the way, of our Bosnian intervention. We've had the 10 years now in Afghanistan, as opposed to a clear mission to go after the Taliban and al-Qaeda, get the problem addressed, and get out. And we now have Hillary Clinton following up on Madeleine Albright and another war, this time in Libya. But listen to what, as I quote from my book, what Charles Krautheimer has to say, and I think this is really at fundamental odds with historic conservatism. He talks about the building of a global dominion as a new world empire. Quote, "We have overwhelming global power. We are history's designated custodians of the international system. When the Soviet Union fell, something new was born, something utterly new. A unipolar world dominated by a single superpower, unchecked by any rival, and with decisive reach in every corner of the globe. This is a staggering new development in history not seen since the fall of Rome. Even Rome is no model for what America is today." Now, that was then, and now we know the consequences of that. But I feel that traditional conservatism agrees with the comments I have from Steve Daskal in my book. "I remain convinced that democracy is being promulgated around the world by American progressives, neoconservatives, and their European counterparts is not conducive to creating limited, federal, pluralistic, market-oriented nations, but rather will lead to the rise of a variety of populist-dominated states that will have strong Islamist and/or fascist and/or Marxist-Leninist tendencies. What made the USA free and strong is not democracy, but rather a limited constitutional federal government with separation of powers, checks and balances, and a host of protections of individual rights against majority power and against the power of wealth or elected office. Democratic elections without all of those structures and guarantees and without a solid Judeo-Christian and common law tradition are not likely to enhance liberty, much less establish it." So I think the direction we need to go, ironically, was reflected in a book by E.F. Schumacher in 1973 called Small is Beautiful. It challenged the notion that bigger is better and called for decentralization when economic, political, and social structures become too large and complex. Schumacher bluntly stated, quote, "Any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex, and more violent. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction." I think conservatives need to move back in the opposite direction to where we've been going in the post-Reagan period of American politics. Thank you.